So welcome to Spotlight on Art with John Costa and Rob Watson. How are you, Rob, this week?
I'm very well, thank you.
Cool. I'm finding this Spotlight on Art one quite interesting. You know, with Anton, there's been some good feedback on our first conversation with him.
Well, I think it's interesting people with interesting stories. It kind of really doesn't matter what the topic is, as long as it's somebody who's interested and having that furrow to plow of the arts as people is kind of better than just giving information about something.
Yeah, that's true. I guess also finding interesting people to talk to, isn't it? And coming on to interesting people this week is our guest, is Joan. Joan Costa, declaration of interest. She's my mother.
Hello.
How are you? You okay?
I'm fine, thank you.
Yeah, great. Well, thank you for coming on to our podcast and talking to us about art. One of the things I wanted you to come on and talk about really was Tina, my partner's at Leicester Museums, an art gallery up on New Wall today with the grandson, Cruz, running a workshop called Museum in a Box, which is about building an explosion box and putting your things in it and stuff. And of course, museums have always played a really big part in our lives growing up as kids in the East End of London, you know, Imperial War Museum, you know, the museum in Bethnal Green and things like that, but also play quite a part in your life of museums that you visited both in London and around the world. So we thought we'd get you to come in and have a chat with us.
Yeah, I'm pleased to do that. I think the first museum I ever went to was when I was in London. I was at school, last year at primary school. I had a very good teacher who said, if anybody'd like to come in the holidays, ask your mum and dad, just bring the bus fare, and we'll go up to the Natural History Museum. And I think my love of museums has sparked from there. We would go different times of the year. I can remember going to Horniman's Museum in London, in the outskirts of London, and that was fascinating because there was this marvellous clock that, when it struck the hours, you had all these saints came through and bowed their head. So you had to be there like at 12 o'clock. It was fantastic. And then as you were growing up, I used to take you to museums. And then when we had the money to travel, we'd go to different big places that had wonderful museums, like the Florence, like the Uffizi, then going to Rome to see that one. And when you have never seen things and then you see all this wonderful art, it just inspires you, because otherwise how would you know what was gone on in the past? The architecture, what people wore, which people was in that particular city. So since then, you know, I've tried to go as often as possible and enjoyed every minute.
It's interesting that you mentioned there about the Horniman's Museum with a clock and a natural history museum. I mean, you didn't mention the whale, because if you talk about Newark, you think of the dinosaur. So you've always got these one or two key objects, you know, or people, you know, like the Picasso stuff, or, you know, certain events and stuff that these things represent, that, you know, we give museums justifiably sometimes a hard time. And I know, talking to Dr. Angela Stein a couple of times about the sort of the role of mummies in museums and keeping, you know, people that have been preserved, mummified in museums, there's those kind of, and decolonization has been a big thing at the moment, but without museums we wouldn't know what these things look like and places around the world. And that's been one of the key drivers for you to visit a museum when you've gone to a city, for example.
Yes, that's correct. I mean, you wouldn't have known that the architecture of the Romans, or the wonderful architecture they had in Italy, and all these different big families who bought things and put them in museums. And not only artifacts, but paintings, lots of things. There's furniture. Lots of them have got clothes, so you can sort of see what kind of things they wore. And that's how you'll learn. And it's also, I think, should be a big part of schools, to encourage schools to take outings, the children, to different museums, so they can see what was about.
Now, one of the things I really wanted to talk to you about is, I remember, this is just a standing joke in the family, really, is that you and Dad, or Dad in particular, got it into his head that he wanted to go and see the Terracotta Army in Xi'an in China in 1991, long before, you know, China sort of opened up to the touristy place that you could go and see now. What was your first reaction what are we going to eat? Because he didn't eat Chinese food. But what was your first reaction when you went about the Terracotta Army?
I thought it was unbelievable, because I'd never, ever thought that he would want to go and see anything like that. But I don't know, it was just one of those things. It just started coming in the news because they were uncovering all the stuff, all the army and all the things like that. And when you got there, it took your breath away. I mean, it was so preserved, and to think that people had found this and they'd gone down and then they've uncovered everything. I mean, a lot of it then, when we went, was still sort of partially covered in the earth, and then those that they'd uncovered, they'd take outside, and then they were sort of renovating them. They were sort of getting a lot of the dirt off. Some of them were sort of perhaps bringing back to life what they look like. And when you look at them, the soldiers, they all look different.
They're all individual, aren't they? There's no two are the same, aren't they?
No. Yeah. But it's fantastic.
But when you look at the story as well, in 1974, you know, as the story goes, there's a farmer or a group of farmers, and they're kind of digging a well, and literally they dug the well into the corner of one of these massive pits, like the size of two football fields. They could have missed it. You know, a couple of feet either way, they'd have missed it completely. And they've found these, they've dug up, I did some research last night, they've dug up 2,000 so far, and they reckon there's another 6,000 there to find. And they're all individuals, none of them look the same. Now, what I find fascinating is we had Vinci on a couple of weeks ago, a Chinese, international Chinese student, and she's from Xi'an, so she's fascinated that you were there 5 years before she was born, which kind of put a bit of a timeline onto it. But she was saying about now, when you go, you know, you can take selfies, there's people posing, talking about, you know, one of Rob's recent recordings, we were talking about Chinese people, you know, sort of going to big places and photographing themselves and selfies. Well, of course, when you went, they didn't even want you to take photographs, did
they? No, you were told you were not to take photographs inside, and they had lots of people walking around looking, making sure you didn't. So I think they'd have sort of got hold of you and escorted you out. No bones about it. You couldn't even do it surreptitiously, you know. It wasn't allowed. That was it. There was things outside that you could sort of see up close and personal, but inside you were looking down, and that was it.
It's fascinating. I mean, I think I put a photo recently on Red Note. With Vince's encouragement, I set up a Red Note account, and we put on the certificate that Dad's got of climbing the Great Wall when you were there. And that's had something like 7,000 views and loads of engagements of people just like, fantastic seeing something like this with old Chinese writing on it. We don't write that way anymore. Other people saying, I've got one of those, I'm going to find it in my loft, or you know, or they tell you how old they were at that particular time. So I think it's really fascinating to be able to have a conversation with a young person like Vinci now, but then talk to you about how something like the Terracotta Army is a symbol of China and drives people. I mean, you mentioned the Romans earlier. It was interesting. We're getting a renovation of our Jewry War Museum as well. So Vinci and I were talking about, well, if you took photos of the Terracotta Army, which according to my internet research last night was 2,200 years ago, the Romans here were 2,000 years ago. We've actually got quite a few connections between her city and Leicester. Mm. What's the other overriding memory maybe you have, just briefly, of China from that time?
It was quite regimented, and it was like going back in time for me, because it was still old-fashioned. It was like how I knew England in like the 50s when I was a little girl, whereas we had sort of moved on a bit by then, so the shops were still old-fashioned to me at that time. The shops had like glass counters like they used to have in Woolworths and things like that in London, and all their electricity, like fridges and washing machines. It was just sort of going back in the 50s. So
I remember you talking about the big sort of heavy curtains on the on the doors as well, because of the cold.
Yeah, it was very cold. As you went up to a big, well, it was an emporium really, only visitors were allowed. The locals weren't allowed in there because you can only use like the international money. And you went up to the door and you had to push through these very heavy, thick doors. And I don't know, there was about like 12 inches each. And it was all like leather on the outside to keep the heat in. And so you push through that and then they close behind you.
Yes. Fascinating. So you're listening to John Costa and Rob Watson on Spotlight on Art. And our guest today is Joan Costa. She's my mum, in brackets, talking about museums and stuff. So now I've got Rob chuckling. I'm going to come over to Rob. So Rob, museums. Yeah, Rob, did museums play a big part in your childhood? Or can you remember what one of your earliest memories of visiting?
Yeah, massive part. So growing up in Liverpool, it was the Walker Art Gallery. And everybody knows the, you know, I think if you come from Liverpool, you... Perhaps it's a generational thing, but everybody knows the painting from the Civil War. It depicts an image of the Civil War, whereas Do You Know Where Your Father Is? That one, the little boy stood in front of the kind of the great and the good, kind of trying to find out where his dad is. And that's like part of the, and then the Henry VIII picture that they've got there. So they were the kind of the two big ones. But there's things like in the 80s, it was the refurbishment of the Albert Dock. So there was the Maritime Museum opened, and there was the Museum of Liverpool Life, which was fascinating because that was the one that kind of in the Liverpool Museum, which was kind of, so when you come out to Lime Street Station, you've got St. George's Hall, and then you've got the Picton Library, the Walker Art Gallery, and then the museum just a bit further along. And then there was one where there was a recreation of a slum street. You know, you walked into the museum, and then there was a Ford Anglia, because that's they used to be made at Speke and that kind of thing. So I always remember they were the places we wanted to go and see, because they were the one that were really evocative of what life had been like in Liverpool in the 1930s or 50s or 60s, that kind of thing. So yeah, and then the other thing was I grew up near a place called Croxeth Hall. In Croxteth, and it had been bequeathed to the city. So there was always that, basically as kids we had kind of free range of the estate. So there was a house, a stately home in the middle, which occasionally was open, but you had the outside and all the kind of yards and any of the working farm, because at that point it had been a working farm, and then turned into a country park. And the other place, Speke Hall, which is over towards by the airport, which is a Tudor mansion. And I think kind of every child growing up goes to those places. So massive part.
I mean, what do you think the role of museums is? Because, I mean, they're all different, aren't they? I mean, Newark has, you know, dinosaurs, geology, you know, people at Leicester Gallery, the big art gallery being renovated at the moment, the Egyptians, whereas Newark Houses Museum, which is our sort of social history and regimental museum, that's got the street with the old pub and the old shops and, you know, how the old sort of shops where you bought items from looks. I mean, it's important, isn't it? One seems to get much more credence than the other one, whereas...
I think that, yeah. I mean, in a way, we went to the V&A a few weeks ago, and a friend, and it's you know, you're walking through the sculpture galleries, and they're, you know, these, the plaster cast galleries that where they've taken, you know, Italian moulds, made moulds of the sculptures, and then brought it back to London. I think museums are a place of imagination, but that's not to confuse them with a place of entertainment. And they're not, you know, sometimes I think it's they get bombarded with too much information. So when you see lots and lots of text, lots and lots of writing, you know, it's like kind of it's too much kind of trying to, they are places where information about the past is curated and managed. But when you kind of, I suppose when you're, I mean, even when you're older, it really is a kind of, it's a space that you want, which is, allows you to kind of daydream. That's what I like about a good museum. So if there's too much information, it doesn't allow me to kind of settle into that view of being able to imagine what these things were used for and how they were brought together. So you can go to lots of museums where they've got artifacts. You know, if you go to Derby and there's the, you know, you can collect artifacts, but if you're not given the space to kind of see it in a kind of situation, then you don't really, I don't really connect with it that way. So it's a kind of an emotional thing, I think.
Yeah, I think, you know, we often don't think about the role of museums and what they mean to us. You know, sometimes you're going for the information, but also it's that opportunity to be in a space where you're not bombarded by social media, or this is the answer is facts and figures. Well, this is more real life, you know.
The best museums are the ones where you can just waste time. You don't have a purpose for going to them. You just go and have a wander around and you absorb it. You don't need to be in, you come out of it with some kind of a purpose at the end of it. You've just spent time there.
So, Rob, you mentioned the V&A there as well. I'm not going to ask you if that's the one in London, because it could be the one in Dubai or wherever, because they see museums seem to have.
It was the one in London.
The ones all over the world now. Oh, you've been into the one in, you know, the Shanghai V&A or whatever. There probably isn't one, but there we go. So, Joan, listen, you go to the London V&A quite often, I'd say, probably once or twice every 1 or 2 years, specifically to think. To look at things that you're interested in. And you went to, was it Audrey Hepburn?
No, that wasn't that one, no. The last one I went to was the, Fabergé. That was wonderful. I had seen quite a few of them before, but they have different ones every year, specific people. I mean, I went there once and I saw an exhibition about... she was a film star, can't think of her name now, married...
Grace Kelly.
So you saw she had dresses, there was a handbag and different things like that. So they haven't got to be... They can be everyday things that you can enjoy to see, because you wouldn't otherwise see them, as well as sort of when you go and see, like, Fabergé, or I think there's one coming up this year that I'm hoping to get to, is Cartier... jewels. I mean, you'd never be able to see them otherwise, so I'm looking forward to that.
But so you like going to things specifically where there's an exhibit that you wouldn't normally be able to get to, because it's kind of come to a venue that you enjoy going to visit.
That's right. I mean, one of them I went to I think last year or the year before, that was the Chanel, and you saw all her suits and dresses. And I mean, even though it's like 20-30 years ago when she was on top of the tree, they're still relevant today. You could still wear them. I mean, if you had a sort of an aunt or a mother who saved all that sort of thing, you could still go in a wardrobe and put it on and wear it, and you wouldn't look out of place, because they're timeless. And, you know, jewellery is timeless. It can be made 10, 20 years, 100 years. You could still wear it because it's still relevant. I mean, that's the good thing about all these museums. You can see things from all different ages and they're still in pristine condition.
Now, one of the things I remember as a kid was the very first trip overseas, going to Paris on Dan Air. Can you believe that? I could still hear these engines revving at Lyd Airport there as we flew. And I think I must have been about 11 or 12, and going to the various museums in Paris, you know, Eiffel Tower, but also going to the Army Museum and visiting Versailles and stuff. And I always remember we went on a coach trip as well, didn't we, for 2 weeks, where the first week was Venice, Rome and Florence, going to different places and seeing stuff. I think we've lost the ability to go and see places just because we can do a 3D interactive immersive tour of somewhere, as if like we don't need to go. But I mean, Rob, we need to still go and see places, don't we? We still need to go and travel and talk to people and learn about different cultures.
Well, the origin of museums in the UK and Europe is that you brought the world to a place where people couldn't travel from. The vast majority of the population, you know, very few people travelled internationally, maybe, you know, soldiers and sailors and a few explorers and civil servants and, people who ran, I suppose, the empire and the rest of everybody else. It was like you'd be lucky if you moved away, you know, from out of your town or to travel to London would have been, or to even just travel on across London in the 19th century wasn't done. So they played a really important role in kind of providing a space for that kind of understanding the world, to begin to understand the world by bringing these collections together, which might have otherwise have been lost And that's one thing that we forget, that sometimes people went, you know, the travellers who went around the world and bought up a lot of these things, bought them from the, you know, at the point where they might, they were being discarded because they weren't valued. In you know, it just wasn't part of the culture. You know, we went to Angkor Wat, and that was hidden until the 1960s. It was forgotten. And then it was rediscovered in I think the 1920s, and brought back to life. And it's like, you know, so there's a kind of sense that you're pillaging other people's artifacts and culture, and there's a point where that kind of the objects that a museum keeps has to be returned, but you're the guardian and steward of those things. So Joan,
yep,
as a mum,
yes,
taking kids, small kids around museums, because my mum used to do that and there were five of us. What was that experience like?
Well, with only two, it wasn't quite so bad.
I was very well behaved. Yeah,
we were. Because I was in New York Museum on Monday, and it's half term. So it's like kind of you walk in, you go, oh God, there's loads of kids around.
I think, well, when we were taking them to museums, we were abroad on holiday. So I think they were more engaged because there was nothing else to do. So they quite liked it and they were seeing different things. And then when you'd finished in that particular museum, you went outside and you had ice cream, which was really nice. So you have to do a little bit of bribery. But I think it's good to get children involved in museums. I think it's brilliant that Cruise loves going there, and he knew his way around and he didn't need to be told because he could remember it from last time he went. So that, I think, is important. But as I say, if you go to different museums across the world, that's good because they must, I think a child can remember seeing something that they've never seen before. And I remember when I was, the first time I went to a museum and I saw a dinosaur, it was fantastic because you'd never seen anything about it. My mum or dad never really told me about things like that. It was just only something, if you were lucky, you learnt about it in school. And I think nowadays they don't really seem to be doing much of that either, which I think is a great loss.
I think there's a disconnect between the national curriculum and museums. Is a key role that the museums can maybe to make themselves relevant as well. And this is the challenge as well, isn't it, about, you know, the price of entry and, you know, museums being free. Newark Houses in Leicester is free. Newark Museum is free. We've got the King Richard III Visitor Centre you have to pay to get into, and Jewry Wall, when it opens, the Centre of Roman Britain, you'll have to pay to get into that. So you've got this, you know, the ability to be able to pay suddenly means your access to additional education. And you can't just say, well, it's online, because then you're thinking, well, looking at something online, you know, with digital poverty and access to the internet and stuff like that in some houses, well, then you're not going to have a challenge where maybe you're not going to be able to access that. It's really important. It's a sort of coalition of people that should be fighting these positions. And I think something like, you know, the Liverpool Museum recently, and the Slavery Museum in Liverpool, getting the funding out of that pot that the new government said they'll give half of the money to the people that, was it the Levelling Up money, I think it was, half didn't. So it was just as interesting to read about the ones that didn't get the money, the impact that it was going to have on their community, as the ones that got the money, because I think they've got to then deal with, well, how do you have a plan for going forward?
Well, I think there's a... You know, you can only pay, you only got the funds that you've got and the money that you've got. And I think sometimes museums are very, very expensive to run these days because they have all these ancillary services in them. Whereas in the past, the best museum I visited recently was when I was in Thailand at the end of last year. And we went to a temple in Bangkok, and in the temple was multiple floors of objects that had been given to the monk who'd set the temple up, and over decades had been given cars and telephones and everything, statues, and there were four floors of this, none of it with a label on. They were grouped together, watches, binoculars, cameras, I mean, just lots and lots of gifts he'd received over the years, and no explanation of them, you know, nothing to explain it. It was just a collection of artifacts, and you had to use your own mind. And I think sometimes what we've turned our museums into, if you like, is a kind of a as I say, about kind of providing so much information that, oh, people can't go to a museum and figure things out for themselves. So we could, probably could cut back some of the costs a little bit. And it's just, what is it? A museum, to be blunt, is a warehouse of things that people have the opportunity to walk around and look at. And, you know, maybe give them a book to look at, you know, rather than having to kind of provide lots of interactive entertainment for them. Is that what a museum is for?
And I guess also, I mean, it's interesting, I was looking at doing a new heritage related project around souvenirs, because souvenirs is French for memories. Something else I learned is the role of souvenirs. What role do souvenirs play in our, you know, the role of the gift shop in a museum is about almost like, you know, emptying your pockets of money of young people in particular, which is why, you know, museums tend to have shops right at the front, is that kind of thing. What do people get? Is it a guide? Is it a postcard? Is it sort of a, you know, a memory, a memento to take home? Is it a fridge magnet? You know, these kind of things. So I think the role of museums also needs to be thinking about, it's not just about extracting money from people, but it's providing things that they can find. So as we come towards the end of a spotlight on art, I'm going to ask Rob and Joan this question now. A lot of museums are a bit like icebergs. Most of it is under the ground, and, you know, us mere mortals very rarely get to go and have a look at any of this stuff. And I guess we're at the behest of the curator, who is, I'm going to put the effort in to change that, to go and see that, which is very difficult when you get caught up with maybe the curriculum, like, you know, seeing the Egyptians or whatever. So, Joan, what would you like to see at the V&A if they were going to put something on? You've mentioned Grace Kelly, you've mentioned Chanel, you've mentioned Cartier and Fabergé and stuff, you know. What would you like to see an exhibition on?
I don't know, really.
Same question to you, Rob. Have a think.
Yeah, I haven't thought about it, to be honest. It, to mind me, because I like fashion and perhaps jewellery, something that's not been on show anywhere else. Something
never before seen.
Never before seen. Mm. Brought to London so that you could see it. I mean, probably this my time of life, I probably wouldn't go and visit anywhere. But if it came to London, I would certainly like to see some exquisite jewellery that's never been seen before.
Spoken like a real Londoner. Jump on that coach, get back to London, get back to the smoke. Rob, what would you...
That's a really difficult one. I think most museums do a fantastic job when you look at it, and the circumstances that we're in and the challenges of, you know, kind of promoting museums. I think for me, a lot of the time, it's that kind of ordinary life, the mundane daily life, that gets forgotten about. You know, the collection of bus tickets, or the collection. I always like, you know, kind of looking through, kind of when you go to Nottingham and you go to Hopkinson's and you're looking around the different floors there, and it's those kind of things. Actually, is that, it's a kind of museum, it's bric-a-brac, and a lot of museums are very good at, you know, kind of building up collections from things that we would otherwise discard. So it's at what point does something become a things that fill the charity shops, and when does it become a museum item? And that transition from one stage to the other is the kind of interesting part to how we build up those collections for me.
Yeah, I mean, that was my motivation really behind the Saturday Heritage Fairs and, you know, doing the Independent Heritage Network. It was always someone coming to you with, you know, a bag of photographs or, you know, some other kind of ephemera that they've got from their family, which, you know, if a museum was interested, or if you were able to access a museum to hand it over, could add to, I'm not talking about changing the timeline, I'm talking about adding to the timeline a real experience of someone that's from your city, your place. And I think that for me is, you know, what drives me. It's those ordinary everyday stories of, you know, Sue saying there that she, you know, she on the previous podcast talking about recording, you know, finding where her grandfather was, and he was a fireman, but then she discovered he was a fireman at the Natural History Museum. They're kind of these layers that will only come from people having these things in their family, you know, those stories in the family. They're not going to be found in a nice neat timeline on a wall in a museum. And I think there's a role that museums need to play, reaching down a lot more and working with communities on these things. So Joan, final word to you. What's the next exhibition that you're going to see in London, do you say, at the V&A?
It's the one about Cartier jewellery.
Okay.
So I'm really looking forward to that because, well, you don't often see Cartier jewellery, do you, every day?
And will there be coffee and cake involved?
Oh, yes.
Okay, so Rob, coffee and cake, is that an important part for your museum experience?
It's not, unfortunately, no. I'm not a cake person, so do you know what the most important thing for me is? Peace and quiet. When you can just wander and you realise, it's like walking around a bookshop and you suddenly realise you've spent 20 minutes daydreaming. Mm-hmm. That's the experience for me, looking at the Cartier watches and just you let your kind of fantasies open. That's the entertainment. It's free entertainment, yes. You know.
Yeah,
that's right.
I think it's fascinating when you find out why people visit museums and what role they mean. I mean, I can still think about, you know, being at school, 6 week summer holiday, on the bus over to Elephant and Castle to the Imperial War Museum, and that big set of naval guns outside. And I think the Imperial Museum's now got what, 5 or 6 different venues, and it Duxford. There's one in the north. There's various different places that you go. So museums, I guess, use them or you lose them.
That's correct. Yeah.